From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, a deeper dive into the $6.3 billion 21st Century Cures Act. Could it fast-track new drugs but weaken the FDA?
Honestly, I'm afraid that by prescribing a new drug or device that's FDA approved, that I might inadvertently harm my patient just because the correct evidence was not gathered.
And the Cambridge Assistant Fire Chief on the latest from that 10-alarm weekend fire.
These folks encountered something the other night that not many firefighters see in their careers.
Also today, Ben Carson could be the next Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. We'll take a look at what impact he could have on housing in Massachusetts. Plus, the hidden history of the Harvard computers, the women who changed our understanding of the stars.
I think there was a connection of working on the stars. It was sort of like being a little closer to God in those days.
It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to start today with more on the 21st Century Cures Act. It's the massive $6.3 billion federal bill that aims to modernize American medical research, and it could have a major impact on Massachusetts' health and life sciences sectors. However, there's a problem. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren opposes the bill. She says it's been hijacked by industry.
The bill cuts Medicare funding. It raids money from the Affordable Care Act. It takes health care dollars that should have gone to Puerto Rico. It makes it harder for people with disabilities to get Medicaid services. There is a lot of bad stuff in this bill. And when the American voters say that Congress is owned by big companies, this bill is exactly what they're talking about.
That's Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking last week. The 21st Century Cures Act is a complex, multifaceted bill that's more than 900 pages long. Between now and when it makes its way to President Obama's desk, which it is very likely to do, we are going to go in depth and explore some of the most important parts of the proposed law. Now, one of those parts is the major changes the Act would make to the FDA drug approval process. The bill proposes reducing the standard of evidence required for several types of drugs and medical devices and allowing companies to market drugs for non-FDA-approved uses. So yesterday, we spoke with Robert Coughlin. He's president of the Massachusetts Biotechnology Council, and he strongly supports the 21st Century Cures Act precisely because it would fast-track drugs that are currently mired in the FDA approval process.
It's not going to reduce the FDA's high standards for safety and efficacy. What it will do is expedite the time it takes to invent a drug. If an existing compound that we know is safe could work for a different disease or indication, isn't that a good thing? I have a child, a 14-year-old son, that has cystic fibrosis. There isn't a treatment available to him today. Wouldn't it be good to know that if there were drugs that were on the market for other diseases would work in cystic fibrosis, we could get that to my son before he dies?
Well, let's get a different view today. Dr. Reshma Ramachandran disagrees with Robert Coughlin. She's the co-chair of the National Physicians Alliance FDA Task Force. And when we spoke with her earlier today, she said she believes the 21st Century Cures Act would reduce the FDA's, quote, trustworthy stewardship of the public health to a shadow of its former self. And she says that should worry everyone.
As someone who's trained in medicine, you know, we often rely on this label of FDA approved to ensure that whatever we're giving to our patients is actually safe and effective. And, you know, removing the FDA out of the equation and instead allowing for clinical anecdotes to supplant the gold standard of clinical trials is not the right way to go.
In your article, you basically said you believe that the FDA, in a sense, is being hijacked by pharmaceutical and medical device companies. And give us an example here, because you also talk about, for example, how the 21st Century Cures Act would, in your words, pressure the FDA to approve new antibiotics and other drugs through a faster pathway called the limited population antibacterial drug pathway. What is that all about?
It actually pressure the FDA to approve new antibiotics and also antifungals and possibly other drugs based on smaller trials in a limited group of patients, which means that more safety risks would go undetected. On top of that, you know, there's only going to be a label there for clinicians and for consumers to be able to know that it was approved through this expedited pathway. And study after study has shown that oftentimes clinicians and patients, you know, don't pay enough attention to labels and oftentimes will use the drug anyway. So we're going to be allowing, you know, just with a label on top, new drugs that haven't been tested adequately enough for safety and efficacy to be on the market for patients. And this is going to be really problematic, you know, as somebody's prescribing to actually make sure that the drug I'm giving to my patients is actually, you know, won't hurt them and actually is effective.
Well, so you also raised some concerns about medical device manufacturers and new rules under the 21st Century Cures Act that would allow for high-risk medical devices to be approved based on a different standard of evidence. Can you tell me more about that?
So right now in the legislation, there is actually a provision to actually allow for manufacturers to make changes to high-risk medical devices without any FDA oversight. Instead, what would happen is that the manufacturer of the medical device in making those changes would actually be able to contract a third party to oversee any sort of safety and efficacy issues with the change to device and not the FDA. In the past, when changes have been made to devices or when there have been safety concerns, we've actually seen manufacturers being well aware of these issues and not letting the FDA know. And this would codify, you know, the FDA's inability to actually provide adequate oversight of new high-risk devices or new changes to high-risk devices and put patients at harm for longer periods of time because the manufacturer might not be, you know, so willing to report any sorts of defects with their devices and would have, you know, huge conflicts of interest by employing a third party to oversee those different changes.
Huh, interesting. So I wanted to touch on one more part of the 21st Century Cures Act regarding the FDA, because this one was very near and dear to Robert Coughlin, again, who's the head of the Mass Biotech Council, when we spoke to him yesterday. And it has to do with regenerative therapies and the use of adult stem cells based on clinical anecdotes, that the act would basically allow the FDA to approve new therapies based on clinical anecdotes and other endpoints. You mean in your paper, you give the example of the shrinkage of a tumor would be enough to get FDA approval instead of proving that a disease was definitively cured. And again, this has to do with adult stem cells. And Robert Coughlin told us that he has no problem with this and, in fact, wants to see this become part of how the FDA goes about approving regenerative therapies. And here's what he said.
I find it hard to believe that the FDA would be approving anything that wasn't proven safe. And first and foremost, you have to realize that people are dying if they don't receive therapies anyway. So again, what is the risk to benefit ratio? We're looking at moving forward as it relates to regenerative medicine, precision medicine. What's next as it relates to these breakthrough therapies? And this bill provides the opportunity for companies to do that.
Another way of putting what Robert Coughlin was telling us is that, you know, he represents within his own family and certain patient populations, people who are going to die anyway, and they are willing to take any chance to see if there's a possible regenerative therapy that could help them. And they've been longing for fast-tracked FDA approval for these therapies, and they haven't been able to get it. So why not give it to them, and why not do it through the 21st Century Cures Act?
So there's a couple of things. So one, when we see patients in the office, you know, the things that we care about are also our patient's overall quality of life. And so the fact that, you know, the drug would be approved based on changes in surrogate endpoints or biomarkers, instead of asking, you know, the questions that we ask in the office, you know, are you feeling better? Is your quality of life better? Is more mortality and morbidity being addressed? These are questions that we think that the drug companies need to answer as well. The other part of it that I think is very troubling to hear, you know, from him is he wants this small portion of the bill to be passed and ignores kind of all the other deregulatory provisions in 21st Century Cures. And I understand, you know, for a number of patients, they want to have drugs now. They want to have new devices now. But if it comes at the expense of undermining the FDA as a whole and the only agency as a practitioner that I can rely on to ensure that drugs are safe and effective, then, you know, I think that's a lose-lose proposition for both my patients and public health.
So let me just jump in here, because let me ask you to clarify here. Do you think that the sum total of the changes that the 21st Century Cures Act, the changes that it's asking the FDA to go through, that it would effectively gut the FDA as an agency?
I do. And the reason why I think that is because, you know, for the last few years since we've been tracking 21st Century Cures, We've heard these same proposals coming. We've heard these same proposals from the pharmaceutical and medical device companies at various meetings, asking for there to be a faster, expedited approval pathway so that they can get new drugs and devices on the market. And not, they're not saying, you know, faster and better drugs. They're just saying faster drugs and faster new drugs. So we're worried, you know, that the bill overall is just going to undermine the FDA's ability to be able to suss out, you know, whether or not drugs are actually truly safe and truly effective. And it would undermine the only agency that we really have out there that's making sure that pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies are held accountable for whatever they're putting out in the market.
So let me ask you a final question. The 21st Century Cures Act did pass by a landslide in the House, 392 votes to 26 votes. The Senate is likely to pass it as well, and President Obama says he will sign it if it gets to his desk. Now, if that happens, how is this act going to change how you treat your patients?
So in clinical practice, you know, instead of relying on this approval process or this idea that the drug has been FDA approved, I'll have to do a second look and take a lot more time in terms of deciding what treatment would be best for patients. It'll be harder to trust that the FDA is doing its job. Honestly, I'm afraid that by prescribing a new drug or device that's FDA approved, that I might inadvertently harm my patient just because the correct evidence was not gathered by the administration, by the FDA, to make sure that it's actually safe and effective.
Well, Dr. Reshma Ramachandran is assistant scientist in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She's also co-chair of the National Physicians Alliance FDA Task Force. We've got a link to her article about the Physicians Alliance concerns about the 21st Century Cures Act. We've got a link at our website at radioboston.org. Dr. Ramachandran, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Well, we're still thinking about that massive 10-alarm fire this weekend in East Cambridge. Yesterday, we talked with one of the survivors, 39-year-old Dana Fuller. His family had owned and lived in one of the houses that was destroyed by the fire. They'd lived there since 1930. And then on Saturday, in a matter of minutes, his house and 16 others on Berkshire Street were in flames.
I don't hear any sirens, so I call 911 to make sure. So within a matter of 2 minutes, the whole neighborhood, I mean, 3, 4, 5 homes at least were on fire. The flames had shot across the street. And, you know, I'm frantically panicking, calling 911, get here. You know, within a minute, my house was on fire. The houses across the street were on fire.
Well, 25 fire departments responded to the call. Joining us now with the latest on the investigation into Saturday's fire is Cambridge Fire Department Assistant Chief Gerard Mahoney. Chief Mahoney, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Well, first of all, I just have to say, job well done to you and all the other firefighters that responded to Saturday's call. I'm going to ask you in a minute more about what that was like, but can you give us anything on the latest on the investigation? Are we closer to understanding what caused the huge inferno?
So our investigation, we have a Cambridge Fire Department Fire Investigation Unit, and they work very closely with the Massachusetts State Police under the direction of the Massachusetts State Fire Marshal's Office. And for this fire, the State Fire Marshal's Office actually reached out and brought in some resources from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms based on the sheer size of the loss, the size of the fire. So the fire investigation actually began, I would say, Saturday evening before the fire was actually fully under control.
Mm-hmm.
And fire investigation is a very kind of detailed scientific thing. It's not one of these, people see crime solved on television in 60 minutes.
Right.
It's nothing like that. So fire investigation today relies on a lot of forensic evidence as well as interviews. And one of the big things today is with social media, we have been getting several videos and photos forwarded to us from citizens, neighbors, people that were in the area, and those have been extremely helpful in determining the cause and the spread of the fire.
Interesting.
So at this point in time, the State Fire Marshal's Office issued a press release yesterday where they feel quite confident to rule out actually arson.
Mm-hmm.
They feel that this is probably somewhat accidental in nature. And we feel very confident that the fire began in or adjacent to The first building that was on fire, which was the as people have been referring to it, the building under renovation at 35 to 37 Berkshire Street.
Right.
So I would estimate that we'll have something more definitive probably in a couple of weeks. The reporting of fire investigation results is a very detailed thing, and this one in particular has to be very detailed because we're dealing with multiple property owners, multiple insurance companies. This is going to wind up, I'm sure there'll be some subrogation law cases down the road.
I mean, forgive me for jumping in here, but it was a big one. I mean, I didn't even know that it could go as high as 10 alarms. I mean,
sure. Yeah.
I guess we're lucky to not see fires that huge around here too often.
Right.
I mean, you're a veteran firefighter. I mean, what was it like for you to witness a fire on this scale? Had you seen anything this big before?
I had not. I commented to some folks over the past few days that the closest thing that resembles what we saw here on Saturday was what occurred back in Lynn, back in, I think it was either 81 or 82, the Lynn conflagration. But that was somewhat different in that was, you know, large commercial mill buildings, some of which have been vacant for quite some time. You know, to see residential homes destroyed like they were was really kind of, you know, devastating in a sense and really struck me. And you know, I was at the scene earlier today meeting with some folks and some of our firefighters who were actually on duty on Saturday are actually the same group working today, and they stopped by to take a look and kind of reconstruct the scene for themselves. And I said to one of them, I said, this isn't something you expect to see in Cambridge.
Right.
You know, this is, you just don't expect to see this in a community like this. But as tragic and as horrific as this whole event was, one of the messages we're trying to get out to people is that this could have been a hell of a lot worse. You know, middle of the night, winter conditions, snow on the ground, things like that. This could have been really, really catastrophic with loss of life.
Yeah.
So we're very, very fortunate.
I mean, we have to reiterate, I mean, zero loss of life. And I have to say, we saw a particular tweet on Twitter, which I think sort of captures a lot of people's feelings about this. The tweet read, 10 alarm Cambridge fire, 120 rescued, zero fatalities. Cambridge Fire Department, you're the real MVP. couldn't agree more.
Right.
Can you just tell us briefly, though, I mean, 25 different departments responded to the call. How does all that work together? How do you coordinate all that, especially in the midst of a huge catastrophic fire like this?
So we're part of a system called Metro Fire, which is an automatic mutual aid network, which consists of about 34 cities and towns and the Massachusetts Port Authority over at the airport. So we have a system in place where the mutual aid is actually automatic,
mm-hmm.
so that when one community transmits additional alarms for fire suppression, neighboring communities automatically are designated to respond either to the fire or to cover vacant stations. And it's a system that works really, really well. It's actually been imitated around the country by other places. And, you know, it's what really helps the situation on the fire ground itself is that we've made tremendous strides in our communications, particularly with radio interoperability. And I got to give credit where it's due. My boss, Chief Jerry Reardon, is at the forefront of various public safety interoperability committees throughout the country. He's actually in Washington, D.C. yesterday and today. and you know, we have the ability, our incident commander, Deputy Mike Morrissey, the other day had the ability to just pick up his radio, key the microphone, and talk directly to any fire department unit that was on the scene.
Wow.
From surrounding Boston. So,
well,
you know, we had companies there from Malden, Melrose, Medford. He could pick up the microphone, key the microphone, and speak directly to them without having to relay the message to a dispatch center.
So a little glimpse there into the coordination between all those 25 fire departments that responded to Saturday's fire. Gerard Mahoney, Cambridge Fire Department Assistant Chief, thank you so very much for joining us, and thank you again for all the work and your fellow firefighters did on the weekend. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We'll be back. You too. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For a couple of weeks now, we've been taking a look at President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nominees and what those picks might mean for Massachusetts. So today, let's talk about the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. Yesterday, Trump tapped retired neurosurgeon Dr. Ben Carson to head up HUD. Carson has no experience in government, and if confirmed by the Senate, he'd run an agency with a budget of almost $50 billion and more than 8,000 employees. Here's Dr. Carson a couple of weeks ago on Fox News talking about the possible HUD appointment and what might guide his thinking at the agency.
Our inner cities are in terrible shape, and they definitely need some real attention. You know, there have been so many promises made over the last several decades, and nothing has been done. So it certainly is something that has been a long-term interest of mine.
Well, joining us now in the studio is Greg Bialecki. He's former Massachusetts Secretary of Housing and Economic Development. He served in that post under Governor Deval Patrick. He's now a principal at Redgate, a real estate development and investment firm. Greg Bialecki, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Magna. How are you?
I'm doing great. So we've been asking all the former state-level secretaries who we've been talking to this week and last an initial question, and that is, how important is it for the person who occupies your position at the state, how important is it who's the head of HUD at the federal level? How much does that matter?
For us, it matters a lot because it's just very simple, starting with the money, that of all the work that we try to do in Massachusetts, affordable housing and community development. The state has been pretty generous. We spend a lot on affordable housing here in Massachusetts compared to other states. Some of our cities, like Boston, also spend a lot of money. But realistically, almost everything we do, we match those resources with resources from the federal government. So if you looked around the city or the state at public housing, at affordable housing, home heating oil assistance for people in trouble, it's very difficult to imagine being able to do the things we do without federal help.
Okay, so I want to dig into that more in just a second. But given that important relationship you just described, what's your reaction to Ben Carson being the nominee to head HUD?
Well, I do have some concerns about it. We don't know exactly what Mr. Carson will do. He doesn't have a lot of experience with housing, and he hasn't talked a lot about it. But I think we do know that he's very unlikely to be an aggressive advocate for federal spending on affordable housing. He hasn't shown any signs that he believes in the mission of HUD as it currently exists. In fact, we think by his comments that you just played that maybe he's feeling like the money has not been well spent and is not really helping the people are in need. And on the ground in Massachusetts, I think we've seen the opposite, that we, you know, as I go around the state, I could take people to dozens of downtowns, particularly of our gateway cities that we've talked about a lot, our older manufacturing cities that have where investments have been made that have been very, very important to them.
So tell me more about that, because, I mean, I think in terms of the dollars spent by HUD at the state level, many people might be familiar with Section 8 housing. But you were
right,
saying a little bit earlier that HUD is essential to the construction of new affordable housing?
Absolutely. So I think almost any project that you see around Boston or around Massachusetts, even you'll often find perhaps Mayor Walsh or Governor Baker, or before that Governor Patrick, at the groundbreaking or the ribbon cutting, talking about a local or state investment. But in almost all those cases, there's been a quiet federal matching investment. The federal low-income housing tax credit is a very important program. Federal assistance for public housing has been very important. A variety of programs and acronyms over the years, HOPE 6, Choice Neighborhoods. But it's quiet money perhaps to most people, but it's hundreds of millions of dollars. I would say even approaching $1 billion a year if you add up all the various HUD programs.
For Massachusetts?
For Massachusetts alone.
So would those new developments of affordable housing be able to be built if that money is reduced or eliminated?
It would be very hard to do that because as it is, almost none of those resources is generous enough or large enough to make a development possible on its own. So you have to cobble together. Often affordable housing or public housing projects would rely on could be 6 or 8 or 10 different funding sources to make it up. So I don't think that there's much reason to think that these federal programs would go away wholesale. But for example, if they were kept frozen or reduced, that could make a very important difference. And as I say, we don't know what Mr. Carson's going to do, but it would hard to imagine that he's going to be an advocate for more HUD spending, at least of the type we've seen. There may be a move. We've seen in other areas towards a privatization. President-elect has talked a little bit about the privatization of infrastructure spending. So there are ways in which we could imagine that a Secretary Carson could talk about less spending by the federal government and more privatizing, or perhaps making more money available to cities and states on block grant basis. Hmm. And, you know, in theory, those ideas have a lot of supporters, but they just haven't has as much proven success of having an active federal government role.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean, I have to be perfectly honest. I didn't realize how important that sort of key, I don't know, gap funding or whatever you might want to call it, comes from HUD is for most affordable housing construction in Massachusetts.
Well, and especially in Massachusetts, because as you know, we have very expensive housing. You know, the examples people always give, Massachusetts, New York, California, the high-cost housing states. And so that means, and that translates not just in how much it costs to rent or to buy, but it means because we have high land prices and high construction costs, it means that even building a unit that's going to be rented for an affordable number, it's much more expensive to build that unit than it can be, for example, in Indiana or Nebraska. And so it requires more subsidy. So I think everyone who is involved with production of affordable housing in Massachusetts is concerned right now.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a little bit more of some of the things that Dr. Carson has said about government's role when it comes to housing and affordability and, you know, what role government should play to support people who need housing assistance. Here he is speaking last year. This is February 2015. He was still in the race as a presidential candidate at the time, and he was speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
It really is not compassionate to pat people on the head and say, there, you poor little thing, I'm going to take care of all your needs, your health care and your food and your housing. Don't you worry about anything, because it's all those bad people who's causing your problem, and I'm going to fix it. That's not compassion. That's the opposite of compassion. That is making people dependent.
So when you hear that, how do you think that might translate into leading the Department of Housing and Urban Development? I mean, could HUD ostensibly change the rules by which people qualify for housing assistance?
That's possible. I think in general, what worries me is that if you feel, as you heard in that clip or the earlier clip about how you know, the inner cities are hurting and we haven't done much to help them, it makes me concerned that he may feel that these programs are easy ones to cut or reduce, and that they haven't done much good. So if we cut them back, there really isn't going to be much of a loss. And I do think also, in addition, in this role, in addition to his managing some very important programs and the money, he's also has a bit of a bully pulpit, right, as a cabinet secretary for President Trump. And I think if he conveys this kind of message, that it's not appropriate to be providing support for people, it creates dependency, maybe it's not a compassionate and appropriate way to deal with them. That's also a message that I would find very troubling. We found, if you look at, especially in a high housing cost state like Massachusetts, most of the people and the families that we are helping through public housing and affordable housing, these are hardworking people. If you work one or two jobs at a minimum wage in Massachusetts, you can't afford an apartment at a market rate in Boston or Cambridge or Somerville. So we are not creating most of the housing. And if you spend some time talking to the people or families in the affordable housing that we're creating in Massachusetts, we're not creating a dependency. We're helping hardworking people.
Well, so on that, I mean, let me just read to you a quotation that's that comes from an op-ed that Ben Carson wrote about fair housing laws that were signed into law by President Obama. He wrote this op-ed in the Washington Times in July of last year, July 2015. He basically said, quote, there are reasonable ways to use housing policy to enhance the opportunities available to lower-income citizens. But based on the history of failed socialist experiments in this country, entrusting the government to get it right can prove downright dangerous.
Yeah, so what I worry about when I hear that is that there are a variety of laws and protections, the Fair Housing Act, access for Americans with disabilities. There's a lot of federal rules about housing, which are actually very important to make sure that everybody has access. And I think he has talked in other contexts about not seeing those rules as being very important and, in fact, interfering with the way local governments or local communities would like things run. I don't think that's such a big Massachusetts problem because we have very strong anti-discrimination laws here. We've had a series of attorney generals, including Maura Healey, who have been very strong about that. So I think that we have our own protections to help make sure that there's equal access for everyone in Massachusetts. But in other states, really, the people who are left out of housing and are discriminated against, their only recourse has been to the federal government for mm-hmm. help. And that may not be here as much.
So final question that we've been asking all the folks in this informal series that we've been doing. If you were back in your old post now and you were Massachusetts Secretary of Housing and Economic Development, what would be your question or what would you be thinking about vis-a-vis the state's future relationship with HUD at the federal level?
So because of what I mentioned before about the money being so intertwined, the first question is just a very pragmatic one, which is at any given time, there's a dozen or scores of housing development projects either under construction around the state or in the pipeline. And a lot of those use some state funds, but also some federal funds. So frankly, if it were me, the first thing I'd be worried about just very pragmatically, how are we going to finish these projects or keep the pipeline going if those federal funds are at risk? And how do we make sure that we can protect ourselves in that way? There's some longer term questions about whether how housing policy will be run during a Donald Trump administration. But the first question is a very pragmatic one. How are we going to get through and complete the things we've started?
Well, Greg Bialecki is the former Massachusetts Secretary of Housing and Economic Development. He served in that post during the administration of Governor Deval Patrick. He's currently principal at Redgate, a real estate development and investment firm. Greg Bialecki, it's great to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Megna.
We'll be back. I'm Megna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the 1880s, Edward Charles Pickering began collecting what would eventually become the largest archive of celestial glass plates in the world. These were beautiful scientific photographs of the stars captured on glass. As the director of the Harvard College Observatory, now the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, he shipped plates from around the world to advance astronomy. The center now houses 500,000 slices of the sky, a century's worth of observations from the mid-1880s all the way through 1989. But even more impressive than the collection itself are the people who were hired to analyze it. They were called the Harvard Computers, and they were dedicated, intelligent women who, crucially, could be paid less at the time than their male counterparts. But they spent decades poring over these plates, delivering or discovering variable stars, counting galaxies, cataloging what we knew about our universe. And they also developed the classification scheme that is the basis for the system we still use for stars today. Well, their story is told by Deva Sobel. She's written a new book about these women. It's called The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And Deva Sobel joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
It's a delight to have you. I mean, first of all, we're going to talk in detail about who some of these women were, but what got you interested in this story to begin with?
I first heard about them from astronomer Wendy Friedman. I was interviewing her years ago when she was head of one of the Hubble Telescope key projects, and she mentioned the name Henrietta Swan Leavitt. as someone who had been fundamental in helping measure distances across space, something that was important to measuring the size of the universe. And I hadn't heard that name before, so I looked into her story and discovered that she was one of many women who worked at Harvard. And that was a big surprise.
Yeah. So tell us more about Henrietta Leavitt. Who was she?
She was born in Massachusetts. She was the daughter of a minister. And she had a college education before she came to Radcliffe. She took more courses here at Radcliffe. And then she got chosen to come and work in the observatory. And she started as a volunteer, but she was given some of these photographs of the Southern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And she noticed a remarkable correlation. For certain variable stars, the brighter ones took the longest time to cycle through their changes. And she knew most of these stars were pretty much the same distance away because they were all in the same group. So the ones that looked brighter really were brighter. And she had the sense that somebody could do something with that observation. And sure enough, by calibrating it, people almost immediately were able to judge the distance to that group of stars, later to judge the size of the Milky Way. And it was that same kind of calibration that Hubble used to discover that there were galaxies external to the Milky Way, and later that the galaxies were actually speeding away from us.
Wow. Now, she's one of the women, one of the many women, as you said, who worked at the Harvard Observatory. They came from all sorts of different backgrounds. Some of them were related to astronomers who were working there?
Yes, at the beginning. Of course, the astronomers just roped in their wives, sisters, daughters. They were there, so... Yeah. They were the labor
force. And they could do
force.
The work,
they
yeah.
Were, they were taught to do the work.
And there was another one, another woman who features quite prominently in the book who has a very different story. Wilhelmina, did I say her name right? Wilhelmina Fleming?
Yes. So she was hired as a maid in the residence part of the building, but the Pickering was the director, noticed that she was really intelligent, and so he moved her over to the observatory part.
Now, how did he notice that if she had been hired by to be a maid?
Well, she was in a delicate position. She was pregnant and desperately needed work and probably answered an ad for something that wasn't up to her full capacity. She had been a school teacher in her native Scotland. So she, and she was very good at math. So at first he had her doing copying, simple things, but after she delivered the baby, he gave her a real job, and she was the first one to look at spectral photographs of stars and come up with a way to classify them into different groups so that people would have a taxonomy.
Well, so there's a detail in there that I want to just highlight, that Fleming had to actually return to Scotland to have her baby.
Yes, she went home to her mother
to
and
Dundee,
grandmother.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then when her child was, a year old, she came back to work at Harvard.
And she left.
And left her child.
And left the boy there. But later he came when he was about seven.
Yeah.
The grandmother came and brought him here, and Mrs. Fleming managed to put him through school. He went to MIT, and he became a mining engineer.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I was hoping you might read a little section of the book where you describe some of the calculations and work that Wilhelmina Fleming did at the Harvard Observatory. Could you do that for us?
Certainly. Mrs. Fleming removed each glass plate from its craft paper sleeve without getting a single fingerprint on either of the 8x10-inch surfaces. The trick was to hold the fragile packet by its side edges between her palms, set the bottom open end of the envelope on the lip of the specially designed stand, and then ease the paper up and off without letting go of the plate, as though undressing a baby. Making sure the emulsion side faced her, she released her grip and let the glass settle into place. The wooden stand held the plate in a picture frame, tilted at a 45-degree angle. A mirror affixed to the flat base caught daylight from the computing room's big windows and directed illumination up through the glass. Mrs. Fleming leaned in with her loupe for a privileged view of the stellar universe. She had often heard the director say, "A magnifying glass will show more in the photograph than a powerful telescope will show in the sky."
That's Deva Sobel reading from her new book, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. There's something beautiful in thinking that, you know, these women who weren't allowed to do the overnight observations.
Not at first. But later they were.
Yeah. But they would come in the next morning and actually they were tasked with making sense of what the men had captured on those glass plates the night before. So tell me a little bit more about how and why Pickering looked to women to do that. Was it simple economics that, like, he could just hire them for less at the time?
Well, I think it was more than that. I think he suspected that they had a particular skill at pattern recognition and patience to look at a field of stars. Some of these images have thousands of tiny dots in them. It's not an easy thing to go through them one by one and make sense of what you're looking at. Each is rich with information, which is why they're currently being digitized, mm-hmm. because they are still a valuable, irreplaceable source of information.
Now, in the book, you also write, I'm having trouble, excuse me, finding the exact section of the book, that Pickering also saw it as an opportunity to give, a chance to give these women an opportunity to do this kind of work that they may not have had after, you know, completing their education in the women's colleges, for example.
Exactly, and he opened opportunities for volunteers also. So at a time when it was a big question whether higher education for women was a good thing, he felt if more women could show how good they were at astronomy, it would be good for everybody. And so he invited them to participate in variable star observations. And women responded and did contribute, and he published their results.
And he named them, right?
He gave everyone credit by name. It's not a chip on the shoulder story. He was very good to the women who worked for him and to the ones who volunteered. And they made names for themselves. And later, fellowship money allowed some women to come in for, say, a year and work at Harvard before going on to another observatory in a full-time capacity.
I mean, he was such a champion of these women that I see here. You write that Pickering actually tried to endorse Wilhelmina Fleming for a very prestigious astronomy medal.
Yes.
And that
he nominated her several times.
And in 1906, she was elected to an honorary membership for the Royal Astronomical Society, the first American woman to earn that distinction.
Right. She was still actually
a Scottish woman.
But yeah. She was working. Later she became a citizen. But she was also inducted into the French Astronomical Society and the Mexican one. So she was known around the world.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about how the work that these women did in their painstaking calculations and observations of what was captured on those glass plates, how it really changed our understanding of the heavens above us, and how much of that is still with us today.
Well, at the beginning of these projects, nobody knew what the stars were made of. Nobody knew what caused them to generate heat and light. No one knew how far away they were. There were many, many mysteries. And Pickering, whose background was in physics, was interested in really looking at the physics of the stars. So this is the birth of modern astrophysics through these projects. And applying photography to astronomy was a brand new thing. It took boldness, foresight, and a lot of money. And fortunately, he had several benefactors who were also women who provided the funding to take on these enormous projects and hire women to do the analysis of the photographs.
The name Draper should pop up here,
yes,
right?
Yes, Anna Palmer Draper was the widow of Dr. Henry Draper. He was a gifted amateur. The amateur astronomers got to do all the exciting things. And so he was pioneering the new field of photographing the spectra of the stars. And just when he got himself organized to quit his medical teaching and devote himself to this work, he suddenly died. And she was determined to carry on the work. She'd been his assistant. And she just couldn't do it herself, couldn't find the proper help. So she decided she would just give the money and the telescopes to Pickering and let him carry it on.
Now, it was in Draper's glass photographs was it in his photographs that Pickering first noticed that he was capturing that spectra that you were talking about earlier?
He was capturing details of the spectra.
Details,
that one else had been able to do. It was a new capability. And Pickering's younger brother was very skilled at photography. And so Pickering thought he was seeing the future.
Yeah.
And he was right.
You know, I'm curious. I'm actually very happy to know that this isn't a chip on the shoulder story.
Oh, yeah.
As you were telling us earlier, that these women, contemporaneously to the when they were doing their work, were getting the credit for it.
Absolutely.
Well, then why is it, though, that, you know, a century later, all of their names seem to be rather a surprise to me?
Well, we forget most names.
But we didn't forget Hubble. I mean,
that's true. And I felt that... since astronomers knew and liked this story, it might have a wider audience. And no one had told the whole story of the whole group before. There's a children's book about Annie Jump Cannon, and there's an autobiography by Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, and there's a book about Henrietta Leavitt by George Johnson. But no one had looked at the whole group and what happened to the science as they made their own progress toward getting the vote and finding themselves a place in the world of science.
Well, we just have a couple seconds to go, and I have to ask you, you've written so many great books about backstory of great scientific advancements, Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, this one now. What is it about these kind of stories that draws you?
They're great stories. I'm interested in them, and then I want to learn more about them and then share what I've learned.
And thank goodness that you do. It's such an adventure reading what you uncover for us. Well, Dava Sobel's new book is The Glass Universe: How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. By the way, she's going to be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge. We've got more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Dava Sobel, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the new book.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I have to say, while we are talking about great women and the stars, I want to take one moment to issue a galactic-sized congratulations to Margaret Hamilton. She is absolutely one of my great heroes. She's an American hero, a pioneering computer scientist, and former head of the software engineering division of MIT's Instrumentation Laboratory. Now, back in the 1960s, Hamilton led the development of the onboard flight software for NASA's Apollo moon missions. And last month, President Barack Obama awarded Margaret Hamilton the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian award in the United States.
3 minutes before Armstrong and Aldrin touched down on the moon, Apollo 11's lunar lander alarms triggered. Red and yellow lights across the board. Our astronauts didn't have much time, but thankfully they had Margaret Hamilton, a young MIT scientist and a working mom in the 60s, Margaret led the team that created the onboard flight software that allowed the Eagle to land safely. And keep in mind that at this time, software engineering wasn't even a field yet. There were no textbooks to follow. So as Margaret says, there was no choice but to be pioneers.
I can't say it enough. What a monumental achievement. Hamilton's mathematical prowess helped rocket humans almost a quarter million miles away from the Earth's surface all the way to the moon, the farthest humankind has ever been from our fragile home. And as happens with many technologies developed for the American space program, the ideas from Hamilton's software architecture exist in countless technologies today. And as President Obama said, she has also paved the way for many more science pioneers to come.
Her example speaks of the American spirit of discovery that exists in every little girl and little boy who know that somehow to look beyond the heavens is to look deep within ourselves and to figure out just what is possible.
That's President Barack Obama awarding Margaret Hamilton the Presidential Medal of Freedom last month. Hamilton still lives in Cambridge and is founder and CEO of Hamilton Technologies Incorporated. Congratulations to you, Margaret Hamilton, if you're listening, on winning the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And thank you for being such a pioneer and such an example for everybody who loves science. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.